Welcome to Ratchet & Wrench Radio, an Endeavor Business Media podcast, bringing you strategies and inspiration for auto care success, featuring the voices of shop owners, thought leaders, and influencers from around the auto care industry. Today, my guest is Eric Schmidt of Schmidt Auto Care in Springboro, Ohio. Today, Eric and I are going to be talking about the feature we did with him in February, You Don't Know What You Don't Know. He's going to be going into some of the challenges he faced early on as a shop owner, some of the mistakes that he made, how he overcame them, why he believes coaching is one of the best things young shop owners or any shop owner can do to improve their business, their processes, and invariably level up their ability to succeed as a shop owner. And we'll get into that right after this message. Psst, hey you. Yeah, you. Can I tell you how fired up I am about the 2024 Ratchet & Wrench Management Conference happening September 12th through the 14th at the Renaissance Orlando at SeaWorld in Orlando, Florida? That's right. Our theme this year, powering your shop, fueling the fun. When you register at rwconference.com, you'll join industry leaders for an exclusive business building conference for auto repair shop owners, operators, and managers. This year, it's a new location, it's a new format, and it's going to be a whole lot of fun. We've got over 30 strategy sessions, we've got roundtables, we've got keynotes. And best of all, we've got lots of valuable networking to put you in proximity of some of the industry's leading operators so you can soak in their knowledge. RWconference.com to register, and I'll see you in Orlando. And now, on to our guest. But hey, Eric, welcome to Ratchet & Wrench Radio.
Thank you.
Yeah, and you come to us from Schmidt Auto Care in Springboro, Ohio. Tell us how you got started in the auto care industry.
Yeah, so I always had an odd love for machines, for sure. And it just kind of, as I was a kid, just taking stuff apart and put it together. I had a white-collar family, so they weren't really enthused with all of that. But it taught me a lot. And then I went off to the military after high school. I did heavy and light wheel vehicle repairs and diesels. We did some small turbine engine stuff. So got a little more knowledge out of that than most people, I guess, get out of our industry. But it was an interesting when I came back home, got a job at a tire store and quickly learned that the diesels and the stuff that we have in the military are nothing like what we have on the road. So luckily, I was pretty mechanical and kind of figured it out pretty quick from there. And geez, man, that was probably in 2000, like maybe early 2000s, I started professionally. 90s, I was working at the dealers at the at high schools. So I was doing pretty good money-wise. And just decided when college time came that college and school wasn't for me. And I was doing pretty good making money at my age. And I said, well, let's see what happens here. And I'd already invested in some tools. And so we just kind of pressed forward on it. I worked for that tire store, which was an extremely crazy, toxic place. And a lot of shops that I've worked at were like that. I myself was a toxic person at one point because I didn't know any better. And I just kind of followed what everybody else did in the industry. But yeah, so I kind of moved through shops, and then I mainly was at a dealership for the majority of my career, probably about, I'd say 15 years total in dealerships. One of them I stayed at for quite some time. And when the housing market crashed, and I was almost 30 years old, and I didn't really play the technician game quite right. I did pretty good with money, but I didn't feel like I played it quite right, and I felt like I was going to be stuck where I was at. And the housing market fell apart, and I worked for Chrysler, so that wasn't good. Consumers are funny, man, because they hear bankruptcy, and they think the place is shutting down. And it's like, man, if you only knew what would happen if a conglomerate like that just up and closed one day. I don't even think that would be possible. But yeah, so the work dried up and the good paychecks dried up and started struggling. And I didn't really understand the severity of the housing market crash at the time. And I don't think anybody really did. And it just went downhill from there. I hung out for eight months making not great money. And I decided, well, if I'm going to go bankrupt, I might as well do it trying something. So we made a business plan, which I'd never done. I have no training in it whatsoever. And just kind of winged it on a piece of paper for dad. Sold some vintage motorcycles I restored and borrowed some money from dad. And that's what got us started. So, yeah. That's where we started at.
Wow. So did you open in 08 or was it after 08?
09, July of 09. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So right in the heat of the recession, which was also a questionable thing, but our business seems to be relatively recession proof for the most part. You know, we have the slowdowns and stuff like that, but I think if you're in a well-run company, I think that they'll continue because people still have to get to work. We're struggling for money, so they're going to repair more instead of buy. And, so there's some positive offsets on our end of things for that and some negatives as well, but, it worked out pretty good. I was in my first building, which was a 2-bay, 1,200 square foot, the old style, like 50 service stations. So like you had the 2 bays. And they were old in-ground York lifts that one was a drive-on, which was super sketchy. And the other one was like a center post, which is just, they're joist lifts. They were York and joist, I think, and they were super wore out. But it's what I had to work with and what I could afford. But our office was kind of attached to the workspace and, you know, just a traditional 1,200 square foot service station from the 50s. I think it was an old Sunoco, and then prior to that, I think it was a Standard Oil place. So it had been around a long time. And I was there for 3 years, outgrew it pretty quick. And one of my customers had recommended a building that was actually in Springboro, which is the next town over. So Franklin is not an overly affluent area. A lot of blue-collar workers there, and they were really hit hard with the Moraine GM plant shutting down. And then we had AK Steel, which was Armco back in the day. So those large industries had put a hurting in a couple of the local areas there, and it, you know, they just kind of remained like that. However, once we moved over to Springboro, we learned quickly that it was a pretty affluent area and we had to change how we did business, to the better for sure. I knew when we started as well that I wanted to change the industry. And the biggest reason is, man, is technicians just don't get treated properly. I think they're pushed to the wayside, and it's funny to me because we're the dudes that make it happen. So if there's no technician and no expertise and no skill set in the back of the shop, what good's the front of the shop going to do? So it's one of them deals where you feel undervalued, underappreciated, underpaid. You got to spend a lot of money on tools. It's the same complaint every technician has, really. And then everybody wants to step back and go, why are these people so jaded? And it's like, man, we're not being treated properly. So I wanted to make sure to change that. I wanted to make sure that people weren't getting lied to and that we had ethics and integrity, which is part of our motto here at the shop, is ethics, superior service and integrity. And I wanted to make sure that people were getting that and the technicians were getting treated well and that we had really nice shop to work in. So kind of the whole package. But the thing was, I had no idea how to make that happen. So I just kind of winged it. I'm the king of wing. So it's one of the things, you know, we talk a lot in town, and I always joke about that because my wife is, we're always very analytical about things, and she gets things set up and she's very concerned about how it's going to work out. And I'm the dude that just shows up and starts talking. So I don't really practice. I don't look at things, and it's not great. And it definitely makes me nervous as well, because I don't know if I'm up below it, but, I knew that all that stuff needed to change, and it started with our consumers. and the back of the house shop, treating our guys properly. So, after those 3 years, we moved to a bigger shop. I think it was around 4,000 square foot, 3,800. We ran there for 5 years, did quite well, grew, hired some of my first employees in that building. And, we grew stagnant at about 500,000. And I actually, oddly enough, reached out to Ratchet and Wrench because I was so enamored by the magazine. And I always was like, man, and you look at all these shop highlights and you're like, man, one day I'd love to be there. And, so they were kind of the only people I knew that was kind of leaders in the industry that I could reach out to and say, hey, I have a problem. I'm stagnant. I don't know what to do. And they actually recommended Elite Worldwide. And so we ended up getting into coaching with Elite Worldwide, which completely changed our business. So they were able to put my vision in motion by allowing us to be more profitable, to allow me to understand how to charge properly, bill properly, for diagnostics, and, you know, just the whole business thing that technicians, we tend to think when we get out or we do side work for many years, right? And most techs do a lot of side work. And we are like, man, if I could just crank out some cars and fix them, we'll make some money. And man, it just ain't that easy. There's a lot that goes to it. The first time you learn about a P&L, you're just looking at it and you're going, man, is this even worth it? Because you see all that big money that you're making, but it all just disappears slowly on down that P&L till that little tiny number at the end, which is yours. And, you know, sometimes you're like, man, I work awfully hard for the little bit of money that we make. But again, I also learned that that's one of those things. When we run a business properly, the technicians can get paid properly. Our service advisors can get paid properly. We can do great things and team events and build really nice shops. And so once I started learning that, we were able to get into the shop we're in now, which is just shy of 12,000 square foot with a 4,000 square foot satellite building. And then we're on par here in the next 2 years to actually purchase the entire property now. So it's been quite the ride. And a lot of learning. So, So it's been a swift kick in the butt year after year for sure.
Yeah. That's quite the journey. I mean, what's it, 15 years this year coming up, right?
Yeah. 15 this year. Yeah.
How about that? Yeah. And so, So, you know, you kind of walked us through the journey. Take us back to year one, year two, year three, you talked about you came from a toxic environment and that was still part of your DNA when you got started. What were some of the toxic traits that you carried over from shops into your shop when you first started?
So it's almost embarrassing to talk about really when I look back at it as an older, more mature person. And I look back and I'm going, man, I feel bad for the people I worked with, you know, because I was one of those toxic people. Now I learned those traits from other toxic technicians and I thought that, hey, this is how we're expected to act. I don't know. I don't know why I would thought that. And then of course, from the military, we're really gung ho about things. We're fast moving. We want results out of everything we do. And the attitudes that we carry with a lack of results, they tend to be carried in the military sometimes too. So, you know, that kind of carried me over. My toxic trait was getting frustrated and mad. And I was very vocal about it. So, I remember there was a time I worked at a Chrysler dealership. It was icy out. Dude had me, one of the service advisors had me park on this incline that I didn't want to park on because it was icy. And I jumped out of the truck and I actually fell underneath the truck. Like I slipped when I jumped out and I busted my knee on the frame and like I kind of jacked myself up a little bit and I just instant rage went mad and I turned around and I screamed at him. And, you know, I'm looking now today and I'm going, man, that was totally uncalled for. Like, there's no reason that we should ever get like that with our coworkers. Like a simple conversation would probably suffice. So once I learned that, you know, I lost a couple employees over it. And I learned very quickly with the guidance of my wife, because my wife is, she's a little bit more level-headed under stress. Well, I wouldn't say under stress. I'm pretty level-headed under stress, but I carry my emotions a little louder than she does. And she had a couple serious talks with me about it. And I realized pretty quick that if I don't change my ways, my business isn't going to work out for me, because who wants to work in that? So I changed my ways. I don't yell. I've never yelled at one of my employees. I just don't do it. We sit down, we have educational talks. We find out why that happened. How can we stop that from happening next time? Or what should we change in our personal that would make this reflect in a better way? I have a couple young guys right now that, and we know the younger guys tend to be a little bit more in their heads, right? So I'm having a lot of these talks lately about, man, just don't worry about stuff like that. But I take it from the experiences that I had in the first couple years, and realizing that my toxic traits peel off into the younger guys. And what I'm going to do is continue this trend into the newer working environment, right? And so when I'm gone, these guys are carrying things that I've taught them, and we can't do that. So we've got to teach them the right way, the right attitude, to move forward and progress and uplift this industry into a more professional industry. I don't think we have a technician problem. I think we have a professional shortage. There's tons of techs, man. We get tons and tons of techs asking to work for us, but I would say about 85% of them are not in the professional realm that we're looking for. But yeah, carrying that over the first couple years was a big wake-up call for me, and it massively changed my outlook towards life and my attitude for sure.
Yeah, I think that can be a big thing. It's like, you know, you have you see it, you know, when you're in the environment as the worker, and you say, you know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it better. When I get my own shop, I'm going to change. Like you talked about wanting to change the industry, but then you kind of bring those traits unknowingly along with you.
Yeah.
And then before you know it, it's like, wow, I'm acting like the person I didn't want to be when I started the shop.
We're making another troublesome shop, and we're just duplicating it, right? So it's like, you know, we got to make a lot of changes. That was the biggest one for me. The other biggest kick in the mouth was realizing I had no idea what I was doing, man. Like I left and I was like, okay, I did all this side work. We've always made this good money on the side, which also allowed me to do what I did. But it's more complex than that. And I think as technicians, we don't see that, and we dumb it down too much in our brains. And we say, well, man, if I could just fix these couple cars, $1,000 a pop, you know, I've got $3,000 in my pocket. Well, no, you have about $50 in your pocket. you know, so you've got to pay a lot of different things. And if you want to run a shop properly, it takes a lot of money to run a shop properly. We have an extremely high consuming business model. But that's kind of what it takes to do these things. And then as I learned the first couple years, my dad came in and helped, and he reconciled parts. I learned to reconcile parts and make sure we're billing properly and this and that. But my dad was a president of a bank, so he's not a risk taker. And I'm a risk taker for sure. And the thing that we all know about business is if we don't take risk in business, we're not going to have that reward. And we also know the bigger the risk that we take, the bigger reward that we'll reap if it's executed properly. So that was my jump into, after we left that building, into Elite. And I remember my dad telling my wife, because we started the marketing thing, and, you know, Laura Lee's quite good at marketing and branding. And so she learned some stuff from Elite and took some stuff from her corporate job. And then I took some of my just imagination kind of things and did some stuff with it. And my dad looked at her and said, if you keep doing this and spend this money, you're going to go out of business. And it was funny to hear that in certain ways, because you're like, whatever, Dad, we're not going out of business from this. But I see where he's coming from an old school perspective. Old school guys aren't doing the stuff we're doing. So they tend to be more conservative in it. But I think that's what's made our industry so stagnant, is because people don't want to take that risk. They just want to come in to work, work on some cars, and go home. But there's much more to that. And I think the biggest thing that makes us successful in our industry is customer service. That's the one thing that I saw and always stuck with me at the dealership, and I still hear it to this day, is how poorly people are treated in the dealership or it's a good dealership, but they have a severe lack of communication between one another. And I see it all the time with cars coming in here, and they're under warranty, and we do an oil change. We're like, hey, you know, your transaxle seal's leaking here. We got our DVI and our inspections and our pictures and all that, the whole nine yards. And then she's like, you know, I was like, you're under warranty. Why don't you take it down to the Mazda dealer? And this was a particular example. And she came back and, or she called me and she goes, hey, they said there's no leak. And I'm going, oh no, did one of my techs do something they shouldn't have done? So I go back immediately and look at her inspection and come find out you can see the oil quite clearly on it. They didn't look at it. They didn't want to deal with it because it's warranty. And that's the other issue coming from dealerships is you have a guy that should get paid, say, 2 hours for that sealing. He's getting paid 0.5 to put it in under warranty. And then people want to run around and go, why don't people ever find warranty problems with my vehicles? Well, if you pay them, they probably will find it. They know it's there. They're just not going to tell you about it because they don't want to get the shaft from it. They shouldn't get, a technician shouldn't get, unless it's directly their fault, they should not get knocked down in any sort of time or pay because they have to do something. It's just not right. It's no different than the guy up front getting paid for his actions. They should get paid in the back. So that was one thing that stuck out, and I wanted to really make sure my techs got paid right. So we don't pay flat rate. We do an hourly plus a tiered incentive structure. So, and everybody seems to like it pretty good. They still shoot for those hours, and I feel like that was a good move on our end to help better all of that as well.
Okay. Now for you, you know, coming into it, you know, like you said, you're a technical guy and a lot of guys come into ownership as technicians. What was that leap like for you? Like, what were some of the things you had to learn and some of the things that kind of caught you off guard, you know, like that you were like, whoa, I didn't realize I'd have to do this as a shop owner. I didn't realize I have to do that. Like you talked about the idea of just, I just want to fix cars still, you know,
yeah.
There's so much more to it.
As techs, when we sell work, we tend to be too technical. I am very guilty of that, man. And I go way above people's heads. I mean, at the end of my career, before I kind of quit wrench, and I still do a little bit, but I was a diagnostician. I still pride myself in being a diagnostician. So I'm a little bit more technical than most of the techs. And so I've learned when I call the clients that I can't be technical. We have to find a way to communicate that, which is why service advisors are so important, because they're that linguist and that link between the front to the back, right? They can understand why it needs the brakes and what's the failure point was, but how do we explain that to the customer when we're selling a $700 or $800 brake job? Because it's not all a little bit of money, you know, and that's a pretty standard maintenance item on a car. So you want to make sure that you knock that out of the park on that and make sure that they fully understand what they're getting out of that job. So, you know, talking about slide pins and talking about pistons and the dust boots. And so people don't know what you're talking about. They just don't. I mean, it's to me and you might be a second language, but to them, it's just foreign and they don't know. They just know they need brakes, but why? So you have to find a different way to communicate that with them. And I think that was the biggest kicker for me, because I had a lot of people go, I don't know what you're talking about. So in that, that's kind of hard to wrap your brain around, because I really want my clients to understand. And, you know, even though when I started off a little bit rocky, I still had good intentions to move forward with things, as we all do. And so I had to learn phone skills and how to talk to people on the phone. Technicians are not the most personable people most of the time. So now I kind of got the gift of gab from my mom, so I don't really have too much of that problem, but I see a lot of technicians that come into the industry and they struggle with that. They're great techs. They can kill it on cars, but then, man, they cannot talk to people. So it just becomes a point where that is also incorporated into the training of learning to open a business, because you have to leave your technician mindset behind and you have to transition into a business person and you have to understand these things and why, because there's going to be a point, if you want to step away from your business eventually, that you have to hire people and you're going to have to train them in your ways. They may know how to do the job already because you hired them as a service advisor, but do they know how to do your job your way and to your specifications? I have a service advisor right now that comes from tire discounters. We had an incident the other day where he had, run down to Fairfield, which is like a 45-minute drive one way. I had left the shop already, and there was nobody up front. And so he had asked one of my lead techs to watch the front, which is a no-no in my business. And it's my fault. I may not have fully explained that he can make these phone calls out to people to pick things up. But so I shot back to the shop and had a conversation about him, and he was fine. But the training, his training from Tire Discounters is never say no. And we know in our type of business model, we got to say no a lot. And it kills me still to this day, 15 years later, to tell people no, because I want to help them, but it's either not in our wheelhouse, it's not conducive to profitability. You may not have the skill set in the back to actually do that job. You may not have the tooling. So there's a lot of reasons why we say no. And Tire Discounter guys, they are a fast turnover shop. They do brake, suspension, tires, right? So that's pretty much all they do. They turn it over fast. So for a service advisor coming from that land, they're going to say yes to everybody trying to get in. And then next thing he knows, he's at the end of the day going, oh my God, I got so much work that I sold, I can't even get through it. And now you're all jammed up. So those types of trainings, depending on where you come from as well, have a big bearing on that to say, hey, you need to slow your workflow down. And it's okay to slow your workflow down, especially if you're a repair facility, because you might have a car come in for an oil change and it might leave with a 12-hour ticket on it. Well, that sucks a lot of time out of one of your guys. So, we want the job, we want to get it done, but we need to make sure it's efficient, and we make sure that we're not piling extra work on top of our tech. So that type of training from that fast-moving pace to the little bit slower-moving shop is one of those things. Now, we're a fast-paced production shop, and I definitely spin a lot of techs' heads off of their shoulders because they're not ready for it. But I'm pretty honest about it in the interviewing process now, that if you can't keep up with a high production shop in a technical environment, it may not be the best shop for you. And I'm okay to tell techs that as well, which is another big thing that we learned is how we hire. I made a lot of bad choices when I first started. So we went through a lot of people when we first started. And it can only be attributed to me. I am the only person at fault for that. So, but you don't know what you don't know. And until you learn it, you're going to continue your same path. So for techs that are starting shops or looking to leave their place of business that they're working at and start their own gig, business coaching, man, it is absolutely been the game changer for our company. We went from 500,000 at that stagnant to elite to, geez, in 1 year, like 750K. And then we've had over $100,000 of growth every year since I've started. So for 15 years straight, almost. We actually had growth in COVID as well. It was a little sketchy there for a couple months, but we had growth there, so I'm thankful for that. But and now we're a little bit north of 1.2 with a stretch goal of 1.9 and a goal of 1.7. So long as we get the right staff in here and we train everybody, the things that I learned, how we want our business to run, we can move forward on that. But
yeah, you talked about just hiring the right people. What were some of the errors you made initially in hiring people? What were you hiring for certain things you were looking for, or was it,
there's so much to that, man. So it's funny because as technicians, when we start a business, we do what we saw, right? Because that's how we learn. We do what we see. And so I can tell you that I never had a proper interview in my entire career working for somebody else. I came in, they say, yeah, can you come in and talk? Yeah, I sat down with them. I give them my credentials from the military. I give my ASE certs. I give them a little resume. And they ask me, can you do this? Can you do that? Yeah, when can you start? We can offer you this much. Well, that's not really much of an interview. And you didn't really find out much about me. And then to my lack of knowledge, I didn't find anything out about the person that's wanting to hire me. So of course we're going to have a toxic relationship because we don't know each other at all. So we learned that if we want the superstars, we want those rock stars in our business, that we have to conduct a proper professional interview. I don't allow or talk to anybody, and I don't allow anybody to come into an interview unless you have a resume made. And I've had people get mad at my counter over it. And I'm like, dude, if you can't put together a resume, what can I expect on the back end for documentation, right? So I understand that it's kind of a hassle and that it's not something you've had to do in your career. But if you want to work here and you want to become a professional and you want to get paid properly, we need to act as such. And so that starts with a proper resume and making sure that we can even make a proper resume, because there are some people out there that just can't do it, which is fine. They're just not our people. So, I started by hiring people by doing the exact same thing about how I was hired. And so I didn't learn anything about that person. They didn't learn anything about me. They had no idea what my expectations in the company were, and vice versa. And we have to make sure that we understand the expectations from both sides of the table, or we're going to have a lot of miscommunication. We're going to have a lot of upset people. So making sure that we lay all that out. So our present interview can go up to 4 hours now. We have quite a bit of paperwork that we go through. We have a technical aspect of it. And then once we do decide to hire somebody, we put it in a professional writing. We do an offer letter that has your loaded, unloaded payroll. It has everything that we offer into the company. It says, hey, you get 6 free oil changes for immediate family and yourself per year, these uniforms, this healthcare, this 401k, all these different things that you would get within a business. Most shops, when you get hired as a technician, you just start work and they say, oh, here's your first car. Well, that's not really great, because I don't know what to do. I don't even know where you store the oil, man. So, like, what am I supposed to do here? So ours is a little different. When they do accept the job, we have 2 days that we set aside for onboarding. They don't work on cars at all. I know some shops that go well past a week doing that. And all they do is train on their processes, their systems, and making sure they understand exactly how the workflow works in that business, where everything is. We usually do a 2-day onboarding, and then what we'll do is we'll do about a week or 2 weeks of training, depending on how green you are. Our A levels, you know, they usually pick up and run with it pretty quick, long as they know where everything is and they know the process. So, making sure that you're developing processes and procedures in a business, is key as well. And the other thing that people don't think about is, yeah, you know, when I first started my business, hey, I just want a couple people to work for me. We'll motor through it or retire and we'll go on with life, right? But it doesn't work like that as a business owner, because we spend more money than we make typically. And so I realized if I don't train people to where I can walk away from the shop and do other things to make this business move better, then I'm probably not going to have a very happy retirement. So process and procedures make that happen to where I can leave the shop. And if I have to leave for emergency or I want to take a vacation, I know my shop's going to function properly. The other thing that does that we don't think about is when you do retire, what are you going to do with the business? What's your succession plan, right? So what are we going to do with the business? Well, your business is worthless without processes and procedures and customer base. It's just not worth anything. It's not easy to do. Us technicians are typically not academic people, so we like the technical mechanical side of things, which is why we excel. I'm not really great at writing processes over here. I know what I want to do. I know how I want to run it, but how do I put it in writing? So it's difficult. And people, anytime people get any type of resistance from a career path that they know well, they typically shut down. And that's where I think a lot of businesses fall short, is they realize how hard it is to write processes and make sure that they're implemented properly and followed, that they just kind of give up on it. And long as their shop's producing money, they don't really worry about it. But in the long haul, it's a big deal.
Yeah. So, I mean, you seem to have it down, like, you know, like you've got like your processes, your systems, like your, like just the way that shops should run. It's very meticulous. You know, do you feel like you would have gotten to this point without, you know, being coached where you were?
No way. There's no way. I mean, the stuff we could have a 10-hour long podcast about this. I mean, the amount of things that happen in a business. So one thing a lot of people don't realize is the automotive business is an extremely difficult business as far as moving parts go. We have, if you compare certain business models to automotive, have a lot more moving parts to it. So what that means is we have to keep an eye on a lot more things, and we have to control a lot more things. And it goes beyond that because we have a lot of things that are outside of our control. Parts not showing up, deliveries falling short. We can't control that. And it's kind of crazy to think that our business models rely on other people to be consistent in what they're doing, but we have no control over it. And so it's kind of a kind of interesting little bottleneck that you can't really ever, I personally have never figured it out yet. I would love to figure out how that works and make it go a little smoother. We're pretty lucky. We do okay. But I mean, obviously I'd like parts to move better in our business, but you know, and then saying, you know, like you had mentioned, we have the parts and the processes down pat, and it's never that, man. Like, I know when we work on cars as technicians, we step back and we're like, man, we got that water pump done. It's running great. We're going to go take it on a test drive. It's awesome. Clients can be happy as could be. Got these services in with it. We're done with it. Boom. Go on to the next car. You are never, ever, ever done evolving in your company, man. So if you think that you got your processes and procedures down, just know in 6 months you're changing them for sure. Because you have to evolve your business with the changing times as well. And I see a lot of companies outside of ours and automotive that are failing and shutting down because they're not evolving and they're not attracting those new clients or guests and maintaining that profitability in their business, which is the utmost important thing of running a business, is making sure it's profitable. So we lose sight of that quickly. And I think that's a big thing, is making sure that we stay ever evolving in our industry.
Okay. And lastly, talk about the evolution of your leadership as a shop leader, you know, as a shop owner leader. You know, you, like I said, you came in raw, you came in, you know, like I said, with some toxicity, you got coached, you learned, you developed, you created the systems and processes, you built the brand, you know, you learned how to treat your technicians, you learned how to pay them well. Like, what was that process like for you, just coming in and just becoming the leader you are today?
Well, there's not much to say about it, man, because I came in with zero leadership. Like, the only leadership that I carried with me was leadership that I learned in the military. And I was a motor pool sergeant in the military, so I knew how to manage people in a shop, but how the military shops work are very different. We have different levels of repair in the military. We have depots that do the heavy line stuff, and then all the way down to the PM stuff, which is preventative maintenance for any of the stuff that's sitting in the motor pools. So that leadership of organizing guys and doing this and that, but it might be you take a wheel off and you go, oh, I got a pitted bearing in here, so I can't pack it. I got to replace it. But in the Army, you got to order it. And when I'm old, so when I was in the Army, it was like on a green screen computer, and it would take like 6 weeks to get the thing in, maybe longer. So there's not a continual flow in that. So, you know, managing people in a shop like that's very different than a shop like this, very fast moving. But yeah, the toxicity, making sure that we mentor our guys properly and make sure that they know that we actually care for their success in the business, because without their success, I have no success, right? So my job is to make my people successful by leading them properly, and then that ensures my success in the business. But I think just slowing down and explaining things, making sure that we ask our technicians questions, not tell them things. Telling people to do things is they're not going to do it. Like, people don't respond well to that. I personally do not respond at all to it. So, and now if you ask me, we have a conversation, it'll get done lickety split. I think there's a certain amount of respect that needs to come into leadership with that as well. I see poor leaders and they get angry and they yell and they raise their voice and they make emotional decisions on things. And we can't do that in leadership. And that is where I've evolved from, is toxicity to making emotional decisions, to realizing emotional decisions are really bad, and then changing my ways to make sure that we're leading people, but we're leading people by mentorship. So we're teaching people how we want things done in our business, and then we get that buy-in, we get that expectation between the two and say, do you understand? Yes. Okay, great. Let's kill it, man, because it's going to work. We know it's going to work. And once you get everybody on the same page, man, it's a nice little machine that starts running for you.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Eric. It was great talking to you about your shop, you know, some of the lessons you learned from early on, and, you know, just your commitment to doing well in the industry.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. It's been an honor.
Yep. And we'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
And that's going to do it for us here today at Ratchet & Wrench Radio. I'd like to invite you to follow us on our social media channels on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, as well as subscribe to our email newsletter, which goes out daily. And you can find that at ratchetandwrench.com. And that's RatchetAndWrench.com. And may the rest of your day be the best of your day. And we'll see you next week.